Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well wherever you are listening. My guest this week is Professor Francois Engelbrecht. He is a climate modeler based at the Global Change Institute at Wits University here in Johannesburg. Professor Engelbrecht joined the Institute earlier this year after 10 years at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, where he was appointed chief researcher in 2016. We chatted a little about the GCI, whose work is to, and I quote, address the problems related to global change, climate change, and sustainability in a multidisciplinary and transdisciplinary manner. So he's a part of a wide-ranging team at the Institute. But more importantly, we looked at his work in climate modeling, particularly in the context of the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, a special report on the impact of global warming of 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. Professor Engelbrecht was an author whose data was used in that report. Particularly, we focus on a number of unprecedented or high-impact weather events, so-called, including the recent cyclones Idai and Kevin that ravaged Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe recently, causing more than 1,000 deaths and leaving tens of thousands of people homeless. And he puts those events in quite dramatic context. It's a sobering discussion, hopefully one that will provoke us all into realizing the catastrophe that awaits the planet unless some drastic action, behavioral change significantly is taken. Please now enjoy my chat with Professor Engelbrecht. Prof, thanks very much for your time this afternoon. We're here at the Global Change Institute, GCI, offices in downtown Bromfontein. You joined here just recently in January this year. Can you tell me just a little bit about GCI and a little bit about the work that you are doing here?
Many thanks for this opportunity, Nicolas. The Global Change Institute here at WITS is focusing on understanding the impacts that a changing world will have on Africa and Southern Africa. So global change, of course, makes up more than what is generally known as global warming and climate change. So I think as all listeners would know, our entire world is rapidly changing as the world is moving towards, for example, a new way of generating energy on the planet. So technology and society is rapidly changing.
Political systems are evolving or
political
or
systems
collapsing.
Are evolving, as we can see every day now. So in this changing world, how do we position ourselves as South Africans and as Africans? But more specifically, of course, in the Global Change Institute, there's a very specific focus on the process of global warming. The associated changes in the regional climate system of Southern Africa and the larger African climate system, and a very wide range of impacts that climate change will have on our continent. My own role within the Institute is to develop specifically a climate change modeling, or what we call a climate change projection capability, for the university and for our country. So it is really important to understand how the regional climate system of Southern Africa will change in response to global warming. We have such a unique climate system here in subtropical Southern Africa. So as the listeners will know, in winter, you know, over the interior, we get almost no rainfall. We have these cloudless days, very sunny days. We can at times, of course, experience flooding as we've seen over the last summer season. So we have a region that is influenced by the tropical weather systems from the tropical Indian Ocean and from tropical Africa
from the coasts,
to the north. But also we are often being impacted upon by weather systems that come all the way from the sub-Antarctic regions or from deep into the Atlantic Ocean. So it's a very, very complex climate system we have here in Southern Africa, we are so dependent on these rain-bringing weather systems, although they sometimes also bring flooding. But to understand how climate change is going to change the rainfall patterns over the region, what it will do in terms of heat waves and droughts, for that one needs a capability that we call a climate model. It's a model with its roots in physics and mathematics. And my field of speciality in science is the development of these climate models and their application to objectively project future climate change over the region.
Without getting too technical, and before we sort of proceed a little bit further with our discussion, how do you, if you could just give us a brief idea of how you create a model and what are the kind of factors? I mean, you've talked about physics and mathematics. How do you, because you're talking about sort of predicting the weather not today or tomorrow, but in 20, 30, 40 years' time. Is that correct?
Yes, that is indeed correct. So climate change projection is about understanding future changes in the climate system. It does not mean that we are trying to predict the exact weather conditions, 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
It'll rain in July or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. On July 13th, 2028.
That is wear a raincoat, yeah.
That's right. That is not the purpose at all of climate change projection. We want to understand how the next 30 years will be different in terms of high-impact weather patterns, for example, than the last 30 years. So to give you an example, fresh in the memory of all South Africans is the Cape Town drought of the years 2015 to 17. Was that drought a natural phenomenon, or was it a consequence of a systematic change in climate? And if it's the latter case, can we expect such droughts to occur more frequently in the next 50 years compared to the last 50 years? And how will the weather of Cape Town and rainfall in Cape Town look like at the end of this century? Mm-hmm. These are the types of questions that we try to answer using climate modeling.
And the recent cyclone that hit Mozambique and Zimbabwe would also fall into that kind of
absolutely
anomalous absolutely. Or natural weather, yes, weather yes. pattern.
Can we attribute the severity of that event? Because let me point out, it was the second most severe flood disaster in terms of loss of life in the recorded history of the Southern Hemisphere.
Get out.
Yes, it was an absolutely...
What the hell? We didn't get that impression, I don't think, by the press coverage, did we?
Yes. In fact, I have a colleague yet at the university who wrote an article effectively stating that the reporting in the media of this event, in the South African media specifically, was underwhelming. And unfortunately, I have to agree with that assessment. This was a terrible disaster. Just think about this. 1,000 people dying in across four countries, as a consequence of this flood disaster. The only event that was worse than this flood disaster is... was caused by a tropical cyclone, I think it was in 1892, in Mauritius. And of course, in that event, it's estimated that about 1,500 people died. But of course, in 1892, we didn't have satellite pictures, we didn't have these advanced numerical weather prediction models that we have today, and that actually gave us a warning of this upcoming disaster about 3 days ahead of its actual occurrence in Beira and Mozambique. So why we remain so vulnerable today with all the technology we have available to predict these types of events is, of course, a big separate question on its own. Was that Mozambique flood disaster made worse than it was supposed to be by a changing climate system? The science, as we may discuss today, is telling us, yes, these types of weather events are becoming more intense, and very intense flood events are starting to occur more frequently in many parts of the world, including in this part of the Indian Ocean that affects us in Southern Africa.
Your expertise was called upon now as one of the drafting authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the most recent report, which looked at... specifically the impacts or the requirements to reduce the temperature change of the planet expected to 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees. I'm kind of saying that quite clumsily. Maybe you can just sort of clarify a little bit upon that and exactly what the purpose of that report was. I think for me, it struck me that, you know, 2 degrees was always, I think, the kind of limit set by the IPCC up until recently as sort of the absolute maximum temperature increase that would still enable humans to, or life to sustain itself on the planet. That has been, well, there's some concern, obviously, that is not correct.
Yes, that is correct. So the 2 degree threshold has been regarded for many years, perhaps for a decade, as the threshold that we should try to avoid at all cost when it comes to warming the planet, in order to avoid what is known as dangerous climate change. Let me also start by saying that right now, the official goal of the Paris Agreement on climate change, which is known as the long-term global goal, is to restrict the global increase in surface temperature to 2 degrees Celsius or less, and that is relative to the so-called pre-industrial temperature of the planet. So the temperature that the Earth has had before we started pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, more or less in the early decades of the 19th century, so the early 1800s. That's the baseline value.
Is that early? All right. I thought it would have been a bit later. Okay.
Yes, and so this special report of the IPCC investigated whether that 2 degree temperature threshold is indeed sufficient in order to avoid the most dangerous impacts of climate change. And a very interesting bit of history around this report is that it was specifically called for within the United Nations climate negotiations process by the so-called Africa Group in the negotiations, uh-huh, and also because by the small island states. And, right, and this is, of course, because these countries
are extremely vulnerable,
are regarding themselves as extremely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. We can just immediately think of the impacts of sea level rise, threatening many of the small island states, but also in Africa, with many of the countries being developing countries, they are highly vulnerable to climate change impacts, more so than the technologically more advanced, developed and richer countries in the Northern Hemisphere. Also, secondly, because the climate system of the African continent is changing quite rapidly. Also here in Southern Africa, if we compare the rate of change to the average global rate of change.
Hmm.
So Africa is particularly vulnerable, and African countries, I must say, have over the years really paid close attention to climate change science. And I think many of the countries have come to the realization that they are vulnerable, and that even under 2 degrees of global warming, they are vulnerable to a wide range of negative impacts on their economies. And these countries then started to ask the question whether we should not, in fact, have a more ambitious goal within the Paris Agreement. And a 1.5-degree threshold is very, very difficult, of course, to achieve, to restrict temperature increase to that threshold. But science tells us it can still be done. And the African countries then, with the small island states, asked specifically for this report to be composed to investigate mainly two things. Firstly, what do we need to do in order to restrict the global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, alternatively to 2 degrees Celsius? And secondly, if we fail to restrict the global temperature increase to these two thresholds, what will the impacts be? Because unfortunately, right now, as I think many listeners will know, we are steaming towards exceeding both those thresholds within this century. We may even say
even quicker than that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very high probability that we will exceed these thresholds during the 21st century. Most definitely if we persist
with the
current rate of emissions, yes.
Mm.
So therefore the report also paid a great deal of attention and made a very, very big research effort, or assessing the research around understanding what impacts will be under 1.5 degrees of global warming, 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming, or 2 degrees Celsius of global warming.
I just want to go back a little bit. We've just spoken about that terrible disaster that impacted Mozambique and Zimbabwe, and in particular the cyclone that killed so many people. That sounds like we've already reached dangerous climate change. How is this term defined within the context of the IPCC then and this 2 degree threshold?
I think there are two aspects that are really important. The first is what we refer to as irreversible climate change. And here we think specifically and in the first place about the melting ice sheets of Greenland and of West Antarctica. So this special report of the IPCC concluded that the threshold for irreversible instabilities within these ice sheets to be reached and initiated, that threshold lies somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. So that means that there's a high probability of that if we should warm the planet to above 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to the pre-industrial temperature, we will initiate the irreversible melting of these massive continental ice sheets. And that will commit future generations on the planet to sea level rise as high as 10 to 12 meters, which is, of course, an exceptional and catastrophic rise in sea level. Now, I must also just immediately say that currently the science tells us that what we can expect in terms of sea level rise by the end of this century is a sea level rise in the order of a meter, or in the most worst case
scenario. At current rates of warming.
At current rates, and giving also taking into account an increase in the rate of sea level rise in the presence of further warming. But the worst case scenario is for a sea level rise in the order of 2 to as much as 2.7 meters by the end of the century, which is, of course, also disastrous in terms of the hundreds of millions of people that will be displaced by such an increase in sea level.
So 12 meters is really something hard to imagine.
Absolutely. Now, that is a catastrophic rise in sea level. But let me conclude in saying that the report has found that as soon as the planet has warmed to above that 1.5 degree threshold, and increasingly so as the planet warms further towards the 2 degrees Celsius threshold, we are facing increasing risks of initiating the irreversible melting of these ice sheets. And the latest science just published in the last few months, even after the report, indeed reports an alarming increase in the rate of melt of specifically the West Antarctic ice sheet. Hmm. So these thresholds are in the first place about trying to avoid what we call irreversible climate change. But the second big aspect I'd like to mention in response to your question is the fact that above this threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming, we will increasingly experience what we may call unprecedented, high impact or severe weather events. And you are indeed correct that such events can already be observed also in our own country. Let me give three critically important examples. The 2015-16 El Nino event and drought over southern Africa is unprecedented in the recorded history of the region. The 2015-16 summer, the period December to February, was by far the warmest summer ever measured in southern Africa by a wide margin. We had the biggest frequency of heat wave events ever recorded across the southern African region during that summer. And at the same time, we had the biggest drought in at least 100 years of record keeping in over the central parts of South Africa, so specifically the Free State and the Northwest provinces. During that drought in the year 2015, Botswana lost 20% of its cattle. And in 2016, it lost another 20%.
Good heavens.
There were also thousands of cattle deaths recorded in parts of South Africa, in the Limpopo province, northwest, KwaZulu-Natal. It was an absolutely devastating drought. It occurred in association with the biggest El Nino event ever measured by humans since 1850. So that the strength of that El Nino can be attributed to systematic global warming. The strength of this drought, and in particularly the high frequency of heat waves that had a devastating impact on cattle in the region, also on the maize crop in southern Africa, is also unprecedented and can also be attributed to climate change. That was the first example. And the second important example is the Cape Town drought of the years 2015 to 17. And I would include in that also the devastating fires. We've had the big Knysna fires and the Garden Route fires, two really mega fire events. So the climate change science tells us that the likelihood of droughts of this magnitude to occur over the winter rainfall region of South Africa and the adjacent South Coast region, the region more or less between George in the west, further to the east, to east of Port Elizabeth, the frequency of drought to occur, the likelihood of these very big droughts occurring in these parts of the country is already significantly larger as a consequence of climate change. For the Cape Town region specifically, that probability is more or less three times larger already than what it's supposed to be. So that is the second example of an unprecedented type of drought in the region. At the same time, the frequency of days with a very high fire danger has already increased, not only along the Cape South Coast, but over much of South Africa as a consequence of climate change. The third major example of an unprecedented extreme weather event I'd like to emphasize is the Mozambique flooding. So the tropical cyclones we've seen over the past summer season were unprecedented in terms of intensity. So the first cyclone, Idai, at some point had the intensity scale of a Category 4 hurricane, if we compare it to the North Atlantic systems.
Right.
When it made landfall, it was of intensity of it had a Category 2 intensity.
What does that mean in terms of wind speed?
That means that when it made landfall, the sustained winds were blowing more or less at average speed of about 160 kilometers per hour.
Jeepers!
Yes, but when the system was at its most intense, at Category 4 scale, it sustained winds at times of more than 200 kilometers an hour.
Just like...
Yes, and the second cyclone Kevin, that made landfall just about 2 weeks later over the northern parts of Mozambique, that system actually made landfall as a Category 4 hurricane.
Cool.
But it was over an area, fortunately, that was less dense in terms of the population and infrastructure and so on. But what I would like to emphasize is that this was the first season in the recorded history.
There's a lot of first in recorded histories here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And all in the last 5 years, all these events. But it was the first summer season with two tropical cyclones of that intensity in the same season making landfall over Mozambique.
Good heavens.
It was also, the second cyclone was also the most northern landfall ever recorded of a system. And it was at about 12 degrees south, which is absolutely exceptional.
Why is that exceptional?
Well, usually these systems form at more southerly, they make landfall at more southerly latitudes.
Because of the prevailing temperatures?
Because of the prevailing climate system, wind patterns, and the temperature distribution in the Mozambique Channel. There was actually a third point about these systems that is unprecedented, and that was also the latest landfall in the tropical cyclone
season.
Because the last landfall was in April, and that was the latest landfall of such a system ever recorded.
Measured, yeah.
So it was an exceptional, wow, exceptional season. But this special report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change you've referred to also made the case very clearly that there's evidence that across the globe, the number of Category 4 and Category 5 cyclones are increasing in their frequency of occurrence.
Right.
It's difficult to measure this change statistically because, remember, we rely on satellites to measure the landfall of these systems and the intensities. And we've only had weather satellites around since about 1979. So, and of course, during that time, right, the instrumentation has improved drastically. So trend analysis is a sophisticated task to perform. But nevertheless, right, the report concluded that there's evidence of these systems increasing in frequency.
Mm.
And then secondly, the report also concluded, based on climate modeling, that we can project further increases in the frequency of occurrence of these very intense tropical cyclones.
Mm.
Secondly, the report made a finding that when tropical cyclones occur, they cause more rainfall than in the past.
So everything's changing.
Within 10 to 20%, that rainfall increase, and that most likely was also the case for the cyclones that impacted on Mozambique and caused these absolutely devastating floods.
So there's two things I want to just get in now. These events are now these sort of unique events, if we want to call them that, or special events, or unmeasured previously events, are happening all over the world?
Yes. So many parts of the world, in many parts of the world, we can measure. In the first place,
I'm not talking just about cyclones, I'm talking about kind of events. Droughts or floods or
across the world.
Queensland, I know, had a long drought and then a massive flood, didn't they, in Australia?
Yes, so what I would say is that if we look at global changes, it starts, when we're looking at extreme weather events.
Extreme weather events, that's what I'm saying.
It starts in the first place with temperature-related events. So there's very clear evidence that the number of very hot days and associated heat wave events are increasingly occurring across many parts of the world. When it comes to changes in extreme rainfall events and droughts, there's less evidence of systematic changes across the world, but there are parts of the world where such changes can be detected. Now, what is important is that in terms of drought, two of the most vulnerable regions in the world where we can already detect changes, as highlighted in the IPCC report, are firstly the Mediterranean region of North Africa and Europe, and the Southern African region.
Hmm.
There are interesting similarities in the regional climates of these regions.
Hmm.
But these are regions that are thought to be exceptionally vulnerable as we move into the next few decades in terms of the more frequent occurrence of heat waves and the more frequent occurrence of droughts.
I just want to now also follow up. You said, you know, just the technology is, for this, the monitoring at least, is quite new when you mention satellites, and also that it has like steadily improved over the years. So the capacity for information gathering has quite dramatically increased since the late 1970s, or certainly certainly since sort of recording began. And I suppose we should also mention that recording was probably only done in certain places, if I'm thinking about kind of colonial governments and things like that. There might have been one office somewhere making some vague recordings of certain events, or perhaps a meteorological office. I'm not sure how in-depth that was. But just to get back to that whole climate modeling and modeling design, you have to sort of now factor in just that pure information gathering capacity into your modeling as well.
Yes, it is critical for the process of verifying these climate model simulations that we have a very good observational record for as many decades as possible.
Mm.
But let me say that the instrumental record across the world starts more or less in the middle of the 1800s. That's when we started to have reliable instruments available, taking measurements of, say, for example, barometric pressure.
A barometer, for example.
Temperature
across
the world. In our own region, in South Africa, we have some weather stations with records that are about 100 years in length. So we have a reasonably good record. Not as many stations as we would have liked to have, but we have sufficient coverage of weather stations.
Interesting.
Mostly maintained by the South African Weather Service.
Yes.
Also some stations maintained by the Agricultural Research Council.
Yeah, yeah.
And these stations give us a good enough idea of the trends in temperature and rainfall that can be detected to date for our own country. And then, of course, an important test for a climate model is whether these models can simulate the trends and the variability and climate that we can identify from the observational record. I'd like to make another point about the Mozambique floods that doesn't relate directly to climate change itself.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just start by saying that climate change projections have indicated now for at least a decade for us the risk of increased flooding coming from tropical cyclones. So from a climate change perspective, we are aware of this risk increasing over time for specifically Mozambique. Of course, tropical cyclones also occur purely because of natural climate variability over this region, but climate change science tells us there's a high likelihood that these systems will become intense. Now, that is the guidance that science provides us on the longer term. But what has happened here in the case of the Mozambique flooding is that another version of the climate model, namely what we call the short-range weather prediction model. We also call these mathematical models numerical weather prediction models. These models gave us excellent guidance about 3 days before the actual landfall of Cyclone Idai over Beira. That there was a very high probability that this tropical cyclone will move from the Mozambique Channel to Mozambique. And the landfall was indeed predicted 3 days ahead of the actual occurrence to be that it was going to take place more or less in the vicinity of Beira. Now, despite of science providing us with this early warning of an impending disastrous event, we have to conclude, unfortunately, that very little happened in Beira.
There was no evacuation
or preparing for the event. What I've been told, I'm gradually, of course, with many other colleagues, trying to understand
do
better what
analysis.
Happened in this case. But in the harbor in Beira, for example, my current understanding is that it was good preparations in terms of preparing the infrastructure in the harbor for the very, very strong winds, of course, the damaging winds that were expected from the approaching tropical cyclone. But the general population, although they have been warned, that's my understanding, by their government of the high likelihood of the landfalling cyclone, for whatever reasons, they didn't really take action. For me, it points to the vulnerability of African countries in terms of these really high impact weather events. You know, there's not a good road infrastructure or a transport system.
Or shelter.
Yes, to quickly evacuate 500,000 people, as happens in the United States when such a system approaches. That was not achievable in the case of Mozambique. Now, the tragedy of this event is that Mozambique is one of the countries in the world least responsible for the increasing impacts of climate change, for the phenomenon of global warming. Yet they are one of the most vulnerable countries in the world.
I was going to say, in one of the discussions, I think we mentioned, we were chatting offline before we spoke, David Wallace Wells has written the book, The Uninhabitable Earth, and I was listening to him in a television interview, and he was sort of saying something along those lines. You know, China is responsible for 25%, apparently, of global emissions, and will only feel one quarter of the impact. India is the complete opposite. It's responsible for a quarter of the emissions, or whatever. It will be impacted four times the amount that it is responsible for, if I can put it that way. And I suppose that is the story of the global south. I mean, just quickly, when we talk about the poor and the vulnerable, we saw even with Hurricane Katrina that many, many years ago in the United States, that, you know, the people who had family to go to or had a car to get out of town, they did do that. But, of course, a lot of people didn't have that capacity. So I suppose in any society, whether rich or poor, the vulnerable will suffer.
Absolutely. I think the statistics you've just mentioned, if we should calculate these for Africa, it will be even more staggering.
Hmm.
Because let me just state that the historical responsibility of the African continent for the phenomenon of global warming and associated climate change is estimated to be in the order of 1%. Where the historical responsibility, that is now from industrialization began until the present day, of the United States is estimated to be in the order of 40%. Yet, the developing countries, as you've also just mentioned yourself, are the most vulnerable when it comes to impacts. So there's unfortunately also a great deal of injustice when it comes to climate change, and in terms of the countries that are affected most, compared to the countries that are most responsible for this problem. Yeah, I would also like to comment on what you've just mentioned about the uninhabitable Earth. This is actually a point I nowadays discuss in great depth with my students when we discuss climate change in Africa.
Shame, yeah.
Because I'm asking my students nowadays if they realize that the Southern Africa, the region that we know today, with all its wonderful aspects in terms of natural heritage and its natural beauty, our nature, our rich natural resources, how different this region will be towards the end of the century in a changing climate system. So what climate change science tells us that if the current rate of emissions should persist, so if we are heading towards the end of the 21st century under a so-called low mitigation climate change future, we will not be living, or the people inhabiting the region at that time will not inhabit the same region that we are inhabiting today.
Hmm.
Just to start,
sure.
To describe the
impacts. Are you talking about empty cities?
Well, for a start, I'm talking about impacts on agriculture and water resources.
Mm.
Let me say for a start that in a warming climate system, the Southern African region, science tells us, is warming at more or less twice the global rate of temperature increase. That's another important fact for the region, yes. Now, if we warm the planet to 3 degrees Celsius, that equates to a warming of more or less 6 degrees Celsius over the Southern African interior. And climate change impact studies tell us that is most likely the end of the maize crop in Southern Africa. So there is no current maize variety
that can withstand
a 6 degree increase in the regional temperature. At the same time, it will not be sustainable any longer to farm with cattle in, for example, the Limpopo province or the Northern Cape of South Africa, and similarly so for Botswana. And in Botswana, we know, of course, that 70% of the population still has some dependency on cattle. So these iconic aspects of life in Southern Africa, our cattle, that is such an important part of our culture also across the region, and the maize crop, our staple food. Those two key components of agriculture in Southern Africa is not sustainable in a warming climate. And from there, of course, there will be a series of downstream impacts on the economy. So indeed, we can say that at least in terms of our agriculture, we will not be inhabiting the same region towards the end of the century compared to the present day Southern Africa.
It just sort of struck me, I don't even know, I just want to put this 1.5 and 2 degrees in context, because how warm is the planet today, and how much has it warmed since, if we say, the 1850s or whatever, that there's a sort of since the pre-industrial age to today, how much have we warmed? So I'm trying to find out how
close we are to this 1.5, 2 degree increase. Yes. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we have so far, since we've started with the Industrial Revolution, more or less in the 1850s, we've warmed the planet by about 1 degree Celsius compared to the pre-industrial temperature. Now, to put that in perspective, when the planet warms...
So it's about 150-odd years or so.
That's right, that's right. Now, when the planet warms naturally, when it changes, for example, from an ice age into a warmer phase, the rate of warming is more or less 10 times slower than the rate of warming we've been inducing over the last century. So the last ice age, and I think we can just all imagine what a different world that must have been. during that last ice age, the Earth is estimated to have been 3 to 7 degrees Celsius cooler than today. But of course, the Earth moves into and out of ice ages over tens of thousands of years. The average periodicity is about 40,000 years. Now, what we are doing now is we are currently busy warming the planet with about 3 to 5 degrees Celsius within a period of about 200 years. So that the rate of this warming is completely unnatural. And that poses, of course, a wide range of challenges to adaptation. Hmm. For a start, if we just think about our natural environment, plant and animal species, of course, evolve over tens or hundreds of thousands of years to much more gradual changes in the climate system. And so, yeah, we are warming the planet with 2 to 3 degrees Celsius in 200 years, conservatively estimating the current rate of change. And that is going to pose a very, very strict challenges to adaptation, starting with adaptation within the natural world.
It's all a bit, I must say, I'm struggling to just kind of mentally cope with some of this information. Just the scale, as you say, the pace, rather. I mean, that was Wallace Wells as well, this guy who wrote this Uninhabitable Earth. He was talking about those sort of misconceptions that he's sort of uncovered. It's the speed or pace, the scope, and the severity of the impact of human activity on, what do we call it, anthropogenic emissions. And I suppose you are kind of reinforcing that for me, unfortunately.
Yes, no, absolutely. So we can rightly say that we live during the time of the Anthropocene. So we are making changes so fast to the planet that at least the rate of global warming and the rate of climate change compared to changes that usually happens over length scales of tens of thousands of years. So we are most certainly changing the entire Earth system in a very, very, very short period of time. So as I've mentioned, yes? As I've mentioned already, it starts globally with the process of global warming, which now threatens an increasing risk of the irreversible melting of the large ice sheets. With that is then associated a commitment in terms of sea level rise that may be in the order of 10 to 12 meters if we initiate these instabilities in the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets, which commits not only ourselves, but future generations to a very, very different planet. But then secondly, there are this range of regional changes. And that is, of course, how climate change is to impact most on Southern Africa. It's not in the first place through changes in sea level. That will also be a factor. But most important for the Southern African region is the unprecedented heat wave events, so these rapid rises in temperature over the Southern African region with associated droughts, and then to the north of South Africa, the increased likelihood of more landfalling tropical cyclones over central to northern Mozambique.
Hmm. That would eventually mean move further and further north, perhaps into sort of Kenya or...
Well, there are very, very interesting dynamics at play when it comes to the formation of tropical cyclones. Let me first say that the rotation within tropical cyclones develop firstly as a consequence of Earth's rotation, the so-called Coriolis effect. And for that reason, it is not possible for tropical cyclones to occur close to the equator. So we never have these systems occurring between 5 degrees north and 5 degrees south. That's quite interesting.
Hence that northern landfall was
that's
quite significant.
That's why it was quite exceptional.
Yeah, okay.
Let me point out that we should also be concerned about the possibility of a tropical cyclone reaching a more southerly latitudes in the southern hemisphere, over southern Africa. Now, some of the listeners, the older listeners, I can say, may remember about a tropical cyclone that, in fact, moved into South African territory. And that was Cyclone Des Moines.
I remember Cyclone Des Moines.
Back in 1984. Yes, Nicolas, so that's...
1984. Yeah. So I remember the bridge across the Tugela River was washed away.
That's right, that's right. So Richards Bay, Impangeni, Kruger Park, those northeastern parts of KwaZulu-Natal and then into the Mpumalanga Lowveld were affected most by Cyclone Des Moines, which in fact moved into South Africa from Mozambique.
And was that an unheard-of event then?
That was an absolutely unheard-of event. That was a very extreme event in terms of the southern latitude. The southern latitudes reached by the cyclone. Now, although these events remain rare because tropical cyclones need very warm sea surface temperatures that we usually find further to the north in the Mozambique Channel in order to form, in a warming climate system, there also exists the possibility that these systems can occur more easily at more southerly latitudes.
Hmm.
Now, we've seen the devastation this system has brought to Beira. But as Southern Africans, we should also be concerned about the possibility of such a very intense cyclone, much more intense than Cyclone Des Moines in 1984. So I mean a Category 4 or Category 5 cyclone.
Landfall.
Making landfall, say, over Maputo. Just think what the impacts of such an event will be on the economy of Mozambique. And it is not impossible that such a system can even make landfall as far south as Richards Bay in South Africa, which of course will also be devastating for South Africa. So these risks of these more intense cyclones making landfall across Southern Africa is a very important aspect of regional climate change. It's in the first place a problem for our neighboring country, Mozambique, that we as a region should... support Mozambique in preparing for. But there are also other countries that will be affected by these more frequent landfall of these systems. As we've seen now, Zimbabwe is also vulnerable. Malawi is also vulnerable. Southern Tanzania is also vulnerable. And it is not impossible that the Limpopo province, Mpumalanga province, and KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, that these three provinces
be in the firing line,
may potentially also be more frequently affected by these types of systems.
You mentioned that the word adaptation, it has a specific meaning in this context, and perhaps if you could just expand on what we mean by adaptation, let's start there.
Let me start by saying that I think South Africa as a country needs to do its fair share in terms of mitigating the effects of climate change. So our economy remains largely coal-based. That's by far our most important source of energy. And we also need to contribute our fair share in gradually moving our economy away from coal as the main source of energy towards alternative forms of energy, preferably the renewable forms of energy. So we do have a responsibility. However, As we've discussed already earlier in this interview, South Africa and the African continent as a whole remains
in the history.
In terms of historical responsibility to the global warming problem, as a relatively very, actually quite a small responsibility.
Because everyone does point to South Africa quite quickly as being one of the highest emitters today.
And we are, per capita, and we do need to make the change and contribute our fair share. But we should also realize that even today, our emissions remain relatively small compared to the carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere by the large developing countries of the Northern Hemisphere. And therefore, mitigating climate change or preventing dangerous climate change is not in the first place in the hands of African countries. We are vulnerable to the emissions coming in the first place from the developed Northern Hemisphere countries. We have it in our own hands, however, to some extent, to place our focus on adaptation. So, under the scenario where the Paris Agreement is not successfully implemented, and it is our responsibility to consider that possibility, we need to prepare for the climate change that will happen in our region. So that means that we must embrace climate change science. We must firstly have a good understanding of what the likely changes will be in the regional climate system, specifically in terms of the increased occurrence of extreme events in the form of droughts and flooding, specifically for the case of Mozambique. With that understanding, we can then prioritize what our main interventions should be. So what is our main strategy as a region in terms of adapting to these impacts that we will experience more frequently? Let me also say that even for the case of the successful implementation of the Paris Agreement in its current form, let's say we are successful in restricting the global temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius, it still implies, unfortunately, that will still imply a regional temperature increase of 3 to 4 degrees Celsius in the Southern African region.
Yeah.
There will be more frequent drought, most likely, and there will be impacts on our maize crop, on our cattle, and on water security in the region. Mm. And from that basic understanding, we need to prioritize how we are going to adapt in various sectors of agriculture. What can we do better as a region? We shouldn't think about climate change adaptation also on a country basis. How can Southern African countries cooperate to better share water? Can we improve the trade of food between Southern Africa and East Africa, for example? Can we do better in terms of transporting electricity between African countries? So there's much to do for us as a region in terms of adapting to the increased impacts of climate change.
I just read this morning, actually, there's a draft national climate change adoption strategy that's apparently been gazetted now. I did not have a chance to look at it, but where is South Africa in this sort of journey to comply?
This is always, for me, a very positive story to tell about South Africa. I think... yes, there is some good news. I think too few South Africans know how proactive our Department of Environmental Affairs has been in recent years to prepare the Southern African region in terms of at least having a solid climate change adaptation strategy. It starts with the department and South Africa as a country having quite a strong presence within the United Nations climate change negotiations process. And in fact, it is also true that our country and the larger Africa group has quite strongly influenced many of the clauses within the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. One of our biggest thrusts as a country or as a continent in the Paris Agreement was to increasingly emphasize adaptation within the negotiations process, so that the focus is not only on mitigation. So I think African countries have been advocating correctly and quite strongly that they do need financial support from the Northern Hemisphere developed countries in terms of adapting to climate change. Firstly, because the Africa group, of course, consists of developing countries, not responsible in the first place for the problem of global warming and climate change, yet they are the most vulnerable. So from that basis, is the need that, that provides the basis for the Paris Agreement to also make provision for adaptation funding.
Yes.
For the developing world coming from the developed world.
Yeah.
Now, South Africa has been very strong within the negotiations process, but then at the national level, we've had for many years a number of preparatory measures towards the national adaptation strategy. Firstly, more or less in 2013, started a so-called long-term adaptation scenarios project initiated by the Department of Environmental Affairs, which assessed all the evidence available at the time of what we can expect in terms of climate change in the region, and how various sectors, from the energy sector to the water sector to agriculture to biodiversity to infrastructure, can adapt to these changes we can expect over the next few decades. South Africa has at the same time been very active in preparing its, what was known as the second national communication on climate change. I think that was back in 2010 when we submitted that to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And in 2018, we've also issued our third national communication on climate change. So unlike is the case for many other countries in the Northern Hemisphere, what I can say is that the South African government, through the Department of Environmental Affairs, does embrace climate change science, and that science has found uptake in the National Adaptation Strategy. So we are in a good position, a much better position in this regard than many other countries are.
I just want to sort of keep on this point and actually quote from the report, because it was, I mean, I would recommend for you listening, if you are interested, to read at least the summary. Limiting the risks, I'm quoting now, this is section D5, I don't exactly know where we are. Limiting the risks from global warming of 1.5 degrees centigrade in the context of sustainable development and poverty eradication implies system transitions that can be enabled by an increase of adaptation and mitigation investments, policy instruments, the acceleration of technological innovation and behavior changes. That sort of kind of encapsulates for me, I think, what is required. But it's, I mean, if you just take one of these, I mean, policy instruments or adaptation investments, these are massive. I mean, even behavior changes, okay, people are stop using plastic, maybe if everyone stops using plastic, but we are talking about a much bigger effort required at so many different levels. About, I mean, if you talk about, you know, can we realistically, or what if we do set the goal of no more coal by, what, 20, what, I don't even know what a reasonable rate of exchange or transition would be. But if the government said tomorrow, okay, no more coal-fired energy in this country by such and such a date, hopefully the sooner the better, how does that then happen?
We should realize that what we are advocating for here as scientists does imply a revolution in the way that we live our lives on the planet. It starts with a global revolution in how we generate energy on the planet. So in order to avoid that 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature from occurring somewhere in the century, the IPCC special report from which you've just quoted has concluded that we need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions with 45% by the year 2030, relative to the 2010 levels. then...
That's 2030.
That's 2030.
That's now.
And then that's not enough. Then we need to press on. And by the year 2050, we must reach net zero carbon dioxide emissions on the planet. So no additional carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere. That is an extremely stringent challenge. Now, the IPCC report looked at the science of such a change very, very carefully. And it concluded that scientifically and technologically, this can still be done. Of course, it requires immense political will. If we do give up on trying to avoid the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold being exceeded, the challenge remains very strict. Then in order to avoid the 2-degree threshold from being exceeded, we must still reach this net zero carbon dioxide world by the year 2070. This implies that if we are going to be successful in preventing the most dangerous aspects of climate change to occur, we will, within the next few decades, will have to make a transition to a new world. We will be driving in electric cars. We won't consume in the same way. We will have massive solar plants.
We may not
wind
eat
farms
meat.
Generating our energy. There will be a bigger component of nuclear planet as well, the report has found.
Nuclear.
Unfortunately, the science shows us that relying entirely on renewable energy is not going to make the changes in terms of the energy mix as fast as they are needed. So we do more or less a threefold increase in nuclear energy generation as well across the planet. I'm not saying in South Africa, I'm saying across the planet. But you can see it's a brand new world we are heading towards. If we are positive and we are imagining a world where we have been successful in reducing our dependency on the fossil fuels. Listeners can also just try to imagine a South Africa where we are not generating our energy from coal power plants. So it will also be a completely different South Africa. Unfortunately, as I've mentioned already, for the case where we are unsuccessful in mitigating climate change, now I'm once again referring to the global effort. If that global effort is unsuccessful, we are also heading towards quite a different Southern Africa. For example, somewhere in the second half of this century, our staple food will no longer be maize. And millions of people in Southern Africa, depending on cattle, will not their livelihoods will not be cattle any longer. So it's a changing world, either because of mitigation or because of the adaptations we will have to make in order to continue to live sustainably in our region.
Where does, we need to finish off now because you've got to get going. Where does technology fit into this? Because sometimes there seems to be an evangelical faith in like, well, let's not worry too much today because in 5 years' time or whatever, before we all die, the technology will be created that's going to save us all.
We cannot count on that. At this point, the technological interventions that are being proposed to turn around the process of climate change and global warming, those interventions are unfortunately still in the realms of science fiction.
You're talking about carbon capture and things like that?
Yes, talking about very large-scale carbon capture and storage. The other big technology, the family of technologies that is being proposed is solar radiative management. We make massive interventions in the planet to reduce the amount of solar radiation reaching the surface of Earth and warming the planet. For example, by pumping large amounts of sulfur particles into the stratosphere in order to reflect sunlight before it can warm the planet. So there's no such a technology. Many ideas are being proposed, but currently none of these are realistically available for us to reduce the impacts of climate change. We must place our focus on what is very much within our hands right now, and that is to systematically and as fast as we can reduce the emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. There we have the solution right in front of us. It will require immense political will and international cooperation to realize that goal, but the science tells us it can still be done.
Professor, that's been horrifying and incredibly inspirational at the same time, and I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me, Nicholas. Thank you.
I had done some research before I met Prof. Engelbrecht, so I had some talking points to refer to, but, you can read about gigatons of this and loss of that and impact on whatever, but, you hear the scope of the challenges that are facing us. I was speechless at times. There are so many things that he mentioned that are cause for alarm. I mean, the recent cyclones, just putting that in the sort of context, their unprecedented destruction and just behavior was one thing. The imminent collapse of the cattle and maize industries in Southern Africa, another. But, what struck me most was his call for a revolution. His call for a revolution in the way we consume, travel, produce, so vast that I cannot see it happening, and the consequences of this action will be dire. I mean, stop all emissions now, just stop driving, stop industry. It's pretty far out. And I'll be following up on this theme over the next couple of weeks as well, just getting different perspectives on the impact of I suppose humans on the planet. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You can also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a review or rating to help spread the word. You can also subscribe via Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.